meeting of the Board of Environmental Protection is being held by a conference call on April 16th, 2020, beginning at 9 a.m. I want to thank everyone for accommodating the modification from our usual procedures to enable this meeting to happen remotely today. I am Robert Duchesne, board member and the presiding officer for the board's consideration of Nordic Aqua Farms applications for a land-based Atlantic salmon aquaculture facility proposed for Belfast and Northport. In addition to myself, board members James Parker, Robert Sanford, and Steve Pelletier will be participating in today's meeting. Board members Susan Lessard, Mark Dubois, and Mark Draper are recused from some portions of the Nordic proceeding pursuant to 38 MRS Section 341C8, and therefore are not participating in today's meeting. Now, before I continue, did anyone have any difficulty hearing me?
No.
Good. Okay, good. At this time, I would like board members on this call to introduce themselves, beginning with Mr. Parker.
Jim Parker. I'm from Visa, but now I'm staying down.
Okay, Mr. Parker, that was a little bit garbled, so make sure the phone is near you. Mr. Sanford.
Hi, this is Rob Sanford from Gorham, Maine.
All right, and Mr. Pelletier, introduce yourself.
Hi, good morning. Hi, good morning, all. Steve Pelletier from Topsom, Maine.
The board's executive analyst, Cindy Bertacci, is present, as is the board's administrative assistant, Ruth Ann Burke. The commissioner of the DEP, Jerry Reed, is also present. The department staff present are Kevin Martin, Nick Livesey, and some of these members may be joining us later, but here's who is expected to be here and who's on the call. Kevin Martin, Nick Livesey, Beth Callahan, Don Hullowell, Greg Wood, Ryan Kavanaugh, Kevin Ostrowski, and Patrick Sherman. Advising the board in this meeting are Assistant Attorney General Peggy Bensinger and Laura Jensen. Other parties to this proceeding that are on the call, please introduce yourselves, beginning with the counsel for Nordic, if you would please.
Good morning, this is Joanna Taranjo.
Oh, it is Joanna.
And good morning, this is David Callen as well. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. And counsel for interveners may be Grace Lobstering representatives.
Yes, this is Kim Irvin-Tucker, and I'm here for the interveners, Maybe and Grace, and the Maine Lobster Union, as well as Wayne Canning and David Black.
Thank you. And if we could have counsel or a single representative for the other interveners, anyone who wishes to announce themselves and introduce.
David Perkins for Upstream Watch.
Okay.
Professor
All right, other persons on the call, including members of the public, do not need to introduce themselves, so thank you very much for the introductions. This meeting is being conducted by conference call due to the COVID-19 public health emergency, as authorized by Public Law 2019, Chapter 617. We're making an audio recording of the meeting. Notice of the meeting and meeting materials are posted on the board's webpage. The matters before the board this morning are MGL's motions of February 14th and February 18th, 2020, requesting that the board return Nordic's applications for lack of title, right, or interest, or in the alternative, hold an adjudicatory hearing on Nordic's TRI. At the conclusion of this agenda item, the board will turn to two other agenda items, voting in the minutes of the March 5th board meeting, and a request to change the public hearing on chapters 156 and 158. Amendments to the REGI rules from a public hearing to a 30-day written comment period. Moving to consideration of the Nordic agenda item at this time, I want to emphasize that the board is hearing oral arguments on MGL's motions. This is not an opportunity to enter new evidence into the record. The record is closed in this matter, and today is for oral argument only. The board will first hear oral arguments from MGL's representative. Nordic will then have an opportunity to respond. Comment from other interveners is at my discretion. Members of the public are welcome to attend this meeting by listening, but will not be allowed to participate in the oral arguments or the motion. MGL and Nordic have approximately 20 minutes each to summarize their respective arguments. I will allow a brief opportunity for rebuttal. Objections during oral argument are generally discouraged. If an objection is absolutely necessary, I ask that the parties participating in oral argument wait until the end of the other party's presentation to raise the objection. Any disputes as to facts or characterization of the record are not grounds for objection and should be addressed during rebuttal. Parties are reminded that all communication should be respectful and professional in tone and content. Following each presentation, I will invite members, questions from board members and then the staff. Board members and parties have received paper copies of the board packet for this meeting. The packet is also posted on the board's webpage. Packet pages are numbered sequentially. To aid one another and to ensure an accurate record, speakers are asked to identify themselves each time they speak. Please use the board packet page numbers when referring to special, specific exhibits. Although I have allocated 20 minutes for presentations, please do not rush. When referring to an exhibit, give board members and others an opportunity to find the reference document, and I'm going to be very lenient with the time under these circumstances. I ask that everyone except me and the person speaking at any given time keep their phones muted. That means there will be a delay sometimes when people unmute in order to speak, so we'll try to honor those pauses, and if I somehow miss something, please feel free to interrupt for that reason. To make this work smoothly, please do not interrupt the speaker. If you must ask a question, please wait until the speaker is finished and alert me by saying, Mr. Presiding Officer, and state your name. To ensure that the recording reflects who is speaking, this request applies to board members and staff as well as all of the parties. Are there any questions before we begin? Okay, I hear no questions. I do hear a chipmunk chirping.
Okay. I thought it was
cricket. Okay. So at this time, I'd like to go to Ms. Bensiger. Before we begin our argument, I'd like to invite Ms. Bensiger to give the board a brief overview of the provisions of Chapter 2 pertaining to TRI and the possible procedural outcomes of the different actions the board might make in the motions before us today. So, Ms. Bensiger.
And if I could just reiterate the presiding officer's request that everyone mute their phones. I'll let you know we can hear some laughing and side conversations and phones ringing. So please mute your phones. It just makes it easier to hear the speaker. And then remember to unmute it when it's your turn to speak. Thanks. Because this issue of title, right, or interest is an issue that is not frequently before the board, and we have two newer board members, I'll go over the board's rule about it and outline the procedural options and their consequences. Chapter 2, Section 11D, which Ms. Bertacci mentions in her memo to the board and actually sets forth, says, prior to acceptance of an application as complete for processing, an applicant shall demonstrate to the department's satisfaction sufficient title, right, or interest in all of the property that is proposed for development or use. The regulation lists various ways an applicant can demonstrate sufficient title, right, or interest, such as with a deed, a lease, or an easement. But the list isn't all-inclusive, and a purchase and sale agreement or an option to buy an easement are methods that are often used. Chapter 2 also says that the department may return an application after it's been accepted as complete for processing if the department determines that the applicant did not have or no longer has sufficient title, right, or interest. No application fees or processing fees are refunded to the applicant if this happens. The reason for this requirement is twofold. It is to avoid the department having to waste its time processing an application for a project that could never be built. And then the second reason is to make sure the department could require remediation or cleanup or closure of a project if a project is permitted and built. A determination of absolute proof of ownership, or TRI, is not required by the rules. The rules merely require sufficient showing of TRI to the department's satisfaction. You might note that the rule says the department, and for the newer board members, the definition of the term department does include the board. So the board does have the authority to return an application if it determines that an applicant didn't have or no longer has sufficient title, right, or interest. The board has three options today, procedurally. First, it can decide to hold an evidentiary hearing on TRI, which would be sort of like the hearing we had before, only just on the title, right, or interest issues with live witnesses and cross-examination. Second, it could grant the motions and return the applications. Or third, it can deny the motions and continue processing the applications. And I'm going to just talk about what each of those means. As I said, the evidentiary hearing would be focused on title, right, or interest. There'd be witnesses, cross-examination, exhibits, etc. If the board were to return Nordic's applications, the application process would be over. The applications would no longer be pending. It would not be the equivalent of a denial of the applications. Nordic could reapply and start the process over. If Nordic were to return the application, if the board were to return the applications, Nordic could appeal that decision to Superior Court. If the board denies the motion to dismiss, the motions to dismiss, which are essentially motions to return the application, and votes to continue processing the applications, the ultimate decision on those applications would contain a discussion on the issue of TRI and a finding on whether the applicant had demonstrated sufficient TRI for the applications to be processed and a decision to be made on them. If the board votes to continue processing the applications, and if the board's ultimate decision was to approve the applications and issue permits, MGL could appeal that decision to Superior Court based on a claim that the applicant did not demonstrate sufficient TRI. So in either direction, there are appeal rights to appeal a decision to court. If the board decides to continue processing the applications, and I'm trying to anticipate maybe some questions, if the board decides to continue processing the applications and the court where the litigation, the quiet title litigation, is going on, issues a ruling in that litigation on the ownership of the intertidal area being discussed today, while those applications are pending before the board could reopen its record and admit that court decision into evidence, with the parties being given an opportunity to comment on it. The court's ruling could definitively address the issue raised by MGL. One last point, if the board were to decide to continue processing the applications and the board were to approve the applications and the court had not ruled yet, but the court subsequently ruled that the Eckrods have no ownership interest in that intertidal area, then the Eckrods would not have a basis to sell Nordic an easement across that intertidal area, if that's what the court said. And the issuance of the permits would not give Nordic a property right to the intertidal area. So the board's decisions do not grant or, board doesn't have the authority to grant property rights, is what I'm trying to say. So that's just the procedural framework. And, suggest that maybe after the parties make their arguments, if you have further questions, maybe hold them until then. Thank you.
Okay. I believe that. Is there anything else? Anyone have any questions before we proceed to Ms. Tucker? Okay. And everyone is muted who can mute while we hear from Ms. Tucker. Is that correct? Good. Ms. Tucker, I believe you're representing Mr. Mabee and Ms. Grace this morning. You may begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Presiding Officer Duchesne and members of the board. I especially want to thank the members of the staff for their tedious Herculean effort to put the notebook together for everyone, and I appreciate that very much. I also want to extend my appreciation for moving this a week. As you all know, I've been battling the plague and the kidney stone for the last several weeks, so I really wasn't up to doing this on the night, so I very much appreciate this movement. One addition I would make to the relevant rules from Chapter 2 is also 11F, which has to do with the burden of proof in governing law. And I would note that that rule states that an applicant for a license has the burden of proof to affirmatively demonstrate to the department that each of the licensing criteria in statute or rule has been met. And it goes on to say, for those matters relating to licensing criteria that are disputed by evidence the department determines to be credible, the applicant has the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence that the licensing criteria are satisfied. So even though we're the movement here, the burden of proof remains with Nordic to demonstrate that the documents it submitted actually sufficiently established TRI. Now, I know this is a daunting notebook. It's almost 500 pages long, I believe. But I do want to say this. We are not asking the board to make a determination of who owns this intertidal land. That is unnecessary, and that is not what we're asking to do. We definitely believe that the record establishes that Jeffrey Mabee and Judith Price are the true owners in fee simple of this property, but that's not something you need to resolve. We also believe that the record clearly demonstrates that the Eckroats do not have any ownership interest in the intertidal land on which their lot fronts, because the intertidal flats were severed from the upland in 1946 on January 25th when Harriet L. Hartley conveyed that land to Fred R. Bork. But again, we do not believe that you need to get to that issue in order to resolve the TRI question in front of you, and I'll explain why. In the June 13th letter that Mr. Martin drafted on TRI, it states in relevant part that with respect to the intertidal portion of the property proposed for use, the department finds that the deeds and submissions, including NAF options to purchase and easements over the Eckroats property, and the common law presumption of conveyance of the intertidal area along with an upland conveyance constitutes sufficient showing of TRI for the department to process and take action on the pending application. This determination is not an adjudication of property rights and may be reconsidered by the department at any time during processing, as applicants must have adequate and sufficient TRI throughout the application process. Accordingly, should a court adjudicate any property disputes or rights in any way that affects NAF's interest in the proposed project lands while the applications are being processed, the department may revisit the issue of TRI. Now, that's a lot to unpack there. First of all, we do not need to get a court to say who does or doesn't own this land for this TRI issue to come back up to the board. First of all, on June 13th, when this was decided, we had submitted a judgment from the Waldo County Superior Court dated June 26, 1970, that already did determine the ownership of this land based on the identical property description in the Mabee Grace deed. But again, even though there is this prior judgment that should have been honored and respected, we have filed another quiet title action in the Waldo County Superior Court because we could not get the state agencies to recognize or honor the 1970 prior judgment. That is disturbing. It has been very costly, but again, we don't need to get to that issue. And why is that? Because at the time this application was filed, the documents on which Nordic relied in filing this were the August 6, 2018 easement purchase and sale agreement that defines the boundaries of the easement being granted, the option for an easement granted from the Eckroats to Nordic as terminating at the high water mark of the Eckroats lot. That can be seen in the easement agreement itself at Exhibit A, which defines the boundaries as terminating at the high water mark. It is a Google Earth image with yellow lines written on it, and it terminates at the high water mark. In January of 2019, the MGL interveners, I don't think we had even intervened at that point, but Upstream Watch and the Maine Lobstering Union and other lobstermen, we objected to the filing
and the reliance on this August 6th document as establishing TRI because it terminated at the high water mark. The department sent a letter dated the 26th of January agreeing and asking Nordic to provide additional evidence. On March 3rd, both to submerged lands and then ultimately to DEP, Nordic filed a letter agreement, they called it. And it was between Eric Heim to the ECROs with an acknowledgement sign dated February 28th by Richard and Janet ECRO. And in sum, that letter said, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but you can look at the document. It begins, the thread of emails with this begins at page 418 of your notebook. The March 3rd letter says, in essence, you intended to grant us a broad easement in U.S. Route 1 and the intertidal zone, and we have the same rights in U.S. Route 1 and the intertidal zone that you, the ECROs, have, including the same rights to site or construct pipelines in that area that you, the ECROs, have. But what that letter never said is that the ECROs have any rights to do anything in the intertidal zone beyond that which every citizen of the state of Maine has under the Colonial Ordinance of 1641 to 1647, which is to fish, fowl, and navigate, and scuba dive. That's the well-known scuba diving that happened in 1641 through 1647. But they did not have a right, nor does anyone else in the state of Maine, to bury pipelines in that intertidal zone. So it never says they did. But the reason we renewed this motion, beginning on January 8th of this year, and then formalized in February 18th filing that we submitted to the board, is because on December 24th, 2019, Nordic and the ECROs extended the closing date and amended the August 6, 2018 easement agreement. And in that extension for the August 6, 2018 easement agreement, two things happened. One, they never amended the boundaries of the easement as defined by Exhibit A in the original document. And two, they had a whereas clause. And that whereas clause specifically stated that whereas as specified in the March 3rd, 2019 letter agreement, any easement rights seller grants with respect to the intertidal zone and U.S. Route 1 adjacent to their real property are limited to whatever ownership rights we may have in and to said areas, if any, and no representation or warranty is made as to any such ownership rights. So in other words, these parties themselves have clarified that the March 3rd letter did not make any representation or warranty that the ECROs own anything. So let's look at the documents now in front of this board. The only documents claiming to grant Nordic the right to use the intertidal zone is an easement agreement for an option to purchase if they get all their permits that terminates at the high water mark of the ECROs lot. A March 3rd letter that makes no representation or warranty that the ECROs own anything in the intertidal zone. But the bottom line is the ECROs have never given an easement to Nordic to use the intertidal zone. Period. There is not a document in front of you between the ECROs and Nordic granting Nordic the right to have an easement over that land. Now, the Maine law is very clear. You can only grant and convey or grant an easement in land that you own. Now, we say the ECROs don't own it. But even if they did, they've never granted Nordic an easement to it that's been submitted to this board. And therefore, there is no sufficient showing of TRI. In addition, in front of you, you've got the deeds going back to 1946 and beyond, frankly, for all these properties. And what those deeds show is that the ECROs property ends at the high water mark. And in
October 3rd of 2019, the Maine Supreme Judicial Court in the Ameter case, a case that Mr. Cowan was the prevailing counsel on behalf of the town of Kennebunkport, the court said at that time that there is no such thing as a presumption of ownership in the intertidal land in the state of Maine unless the source deed itself grants a right to the intertidal land. And where in Maine, there, because you can sever the upland and the intertidal flats, it is imperative to look at the source deed. Here, the source deeds all terminate at the intertidal land, the high water mark of Penobscot Bay. It talks about, it goes to an iron bolt at the mouth of a brook. Not the mouth of a brook, but an iron bolt at the mouth of a brook. That's an identifiable point on the face of the earth that you have in front of you on these surveys. That goes along the high water mark of Penobscot Bay to a stake at the outlet of a gully. Not at the outlet of a gully, some imaginary thing that may move or may be down by the low water mark. There is a stake in the earth that was placed there in August 31st or before in 2012 by Good Deed Surveyors, who were the ones that the Eckroats commissioned to survey the land owned by Phyllis J. Poor, Janet Eckroats' mother, prior to her death. And where that stake and that pin are on the face of the earth at the mouth of the brook and the outlet of the gully can be seen on the surveys that are in front of you. If you look at the survey at page 58, you can see that Gustav Ronson of Good Deeds identifies the waterside boundary of the Eckroats lot as along high water. That's not a something we have to interpret. She wrote it in plain English words along the high water mark. And you can see the pins that are placed on the face of the earth. And they're in the upland, and there's a spot there at the mouth of the brook, and there's a spot that's there that's rebar that's put with a cap on it that's been relocated by Don Richards, our surveyor. It was also identified by another Good Deed surveyor, Clark Staples, on April 2nd, 2018, who also identified that the Eckroats property boundary, waterside boundary, is the high water mark of Penobscot Bay, not the low water mark. In the state of Maine, when a survey and a description in a deed differ, and the survey has been incorporated by reference into the deed, the survey controls over competing words. In 2012, we know that there was the phrase added. Instead of along high watermark of Penobscot Bay, Lee Woodward, the lawyer for the personal representative of Phyllis J. Poor's estate, changed those words from along high watermark of Penobscot Bay to along said bay, implying the low watermark. But he also said to the pin at the mouth of the brook, to the pin at the outlet of the gully. Those things are identified on the face of the earth as being above that. Whatever ambiguity was may have been created by that, it is resolved by looking at the August 31st, 2012 survey, which is at page 58 of your notebook. When you look at that document, you can see that the Eckroat surveyor established that the boundary of the Eckroats lot was along the high water mark, not low. They do not, and then to clarify on page 57, Dr. Ronson wrote a letter to Don Richards specifically stating that they found no evidence of any ownership interest in the intertidal land by the Eckroats. It specifically says, we found no deeded information or language that indicated fee title of this parcel included the intertidal zone, and by language at its creation specifically stopped at the high water. The purpose of this survey was to clarify the boundaries as the description within the deed to Phyllis Poor contained two parcels and a line agreement which did not provide specific cohesive description on its face. There is no note saying title would extend to low water. That's their surveyor. And then again, If you look at the document at page 62, this is the survey that Nordic had done prior to even entering the easement agreement with the ECRO. And during that, the surveyor wrote the following language in all caps in the water there. There's tiny little letters there. You'll see them in all caps on page 62. I'll read what the words say. Shaded area depicts lands located below the high tide line. The deed from the estate of Phyllis J. Poor to Richard and Janet Eckroth, dated October 15, 2012, and recorded in book 3697, page 5, contains the language, quote, thence generally southwesterly along said, meaning Penobscot Bay, a distance of 425 feet. The previous deed from William O. and Phyllis J. Poor to Phyllis J. Poor, dated July 1, 1991, recorded in book 1228, page 346, contains the language, quote, thence easterly and northeasterly along high water mark of Penobscot Bay, 410 feet, close quote. I suggest a legal opinion of the ability of the estate of Phyllis J. Poor to grant an easement below the high water mark. Now, this placed Nordic on notice as early as April 2nd, 2018 from their own surveyor, and they had access to the 2012 deed, which previously said along high water was the boundary of the Eckroth lot. Nordic has at all times been on notice that the Eckroths had no ability to grant them an easement beyond that. Maine law is very clear, which was reaffirmed in the Almeter decision, that one cannot convey land that they do not own and cannot grant an easement in land they do not own. And you cannot resurrect an interest in the intertidal zone by adding words like Mr. Woodward did in 2012 in the October 15th deed. That's specifically stated in the Almeter decision by the Maine Supreme Judicial Court, stating the court correctly concluded that the beachfront owners do not benefit from the colonial ordinance presumption because their source deeds do not include a call to the water or even to the shore. The foundational deeds and incorporated plans in the other title chains similarly destroy any presumption that the beachfront owners owned the low water mark. In most of the title chains, language referencing the water was added in later deeds. These late additions do not resurrect the presumption of ownership to the low water mark, citing Eaton, 2000 Maine, 176 at paragraph 19, noting that a person can convey only what is conveyed into them. So although we say that the record before you shows that the Eckroth deeds do not include the intertidal land, more importantly, even if they owned that, the record before you shows that they've never granted an easement to Nordic below the high water mark. Now, perhaps that's because the same lawyer, Lee Woodward, wrote the October 2012 deed, where even though he added the Hinkley words, he knew it ended at the high water mark because he's the same lawyer that represented the Eckroths in writing the March 3rd letter, in doing the 12-24-2019 amendment, and in doing the 2018 easement agreement, which ends at the high water mark because he knows they don't own beyond that. So I'm saying the record before you already establishes that there is nothing in this record to show any title right or interest in the intertidal zone by Nordic, let alone sufficient. In addition, and finally, we have given two documents to you that are prior court judgments. One, I've already referenced, which is the decision in Ferris versus Hargrave, where the court quieted title using the identical deed description that's in the Maybe Grace deed in Winston Ferris. And if you look at the seven sketches from Don Richards that are in your package, those seven sketches also contain, and I'm going to look at the page numbers for you. I'm sorry. Let me look at the page numbers so I can. This is fairly far back in the document here. Uh-huh. redacted page 193, 195, and one, no, those are the redacted dates. I'm sorry.
Excuse me, this is Cindy Bertacci speaking.
Yes.
Sketches begin on page 238 of the packet.
Great, thank you very much. If you look at those sketches, especially sketches 5, 6, and 7, you'll see what was conveyed out by Harriet Hartley. You have a document in the record here from at page 145, which is the letter from Jim Dorsky to Eric Kime. It begins at page 145. And at page 145 and 146, Jim Dorsky, who's also a surveyor retained by Nordic, expressly states and agrees that there was a severance of the uplands from the intertidal flats. But he goes on to say that his belief is that in September of 1950, when Harriet Hartley conveyed the remainder of her land to the Butlers, that she somehow, by using the description, the abutters' description of north by land of Fred R. Poor, east by Penobscot Bay, south by Little River, west by Atlantic Highway, so-called, that abutters' description drew an imaginary line between what is now called lots 37 and 36, and that the intertidal land in front of lots 36 and most of 35, the old Fred R. Poor waterfront boundary, was somehow retained by Harriet Hartley. Now, that's a nice theory, but it's not supported by law, because at the time of Harriet Hartley's death in 1951, the Orphans Court in Philadelphia, through the Philadelphia Register of Wills, made a determination that at the time of her death on October 18th, 1951, Harriet had already, during life, more than 12 months before, conveyed all of her land covered by her 1945 will, which is the land up in Maine, and that at the time of her death, she owned no real property. And as a result, it rendered her will conveying that land and whatever of that land she continued to retain, it rendered it ineffective. And the two people she had named as her heirs, her nephew, Samuel Nelson Woods Jr., and her sister-in-law, Ruth Hartley Weaver, got nothing from her will conveying any land, because there was no land to convey according to the Orphans Court. And as a consequence, no appeal was ever filed by the heirs that got nothing. And instead, the heirs at law were then designated her two sisters, Genevieve Hargrave Bailey and Esther Hargrave Wood. They were the two people that were her heirs at law, and they got no property. And so again, going back to the Almeida decision and all the other prior decisions in the state of Maine, you cannot convey that which you do not own. I do not know, because we have not been able to get the information, who the supposed release deeds were that were filed June 10th with the department are. I have no idea who those people are. But what I can tell you is this. They are not heirs at law of Harriet L. Hartley. They may be some blood relative coming from Samuel Woods' two children, one of whom had two children. I have no idea. But I know what they aren't, and that's heirs at law under Pennsylvania law at the time of Harriet's death. Because at the time of Harriet's death, there were two heirs at law that were designated, her two sisters. Both of them died. Esther died on May 1st, 1957, and Genevieve died on April 19th, 1956. So neither one of them in 2019 signed whatever these release deeds were. The release deeds also convey whatever interest they may or may not have had based on the deed of Genevieve Hargrave to Arthur and Harriet L. Hartley, dated August 27, 1934. That deed is exactly the deed that in the 1970 Ferris versus Hargrave decision, the Waldo County Superior Court extinguished the right and barred anyone claiming under Genevieve Hargrave and that deed from ever asserting title, right, interest, or estate in the land described in the judgment, which is the identical land described in my client's deed and described in that judgment. And so, again, I don't know who those people are that Nordic has cooked up these, quote, release deeds from,
but they convey no title to land. They certainly do not convey title to this intertidal land, and they certainly do not convey any title, interest, or estate in this land that is legal, because a prior court judgment extinguished that in 1970, and that is in the chain of title in the Waldo County Superior Court, which clearly this applicant knows. So that's the conclusion of what my reference is to. If you have any questions, please let me know.
Yes, this is the time we would go to the board first and then staff to ask any questions. So are there board members who would like to ask a question?
Jim Parker, no.
Any other board members wish to ask a question? Hearing none, I will ask one, I think. Obviously, there's a lot of... I believe, Ms. Tucker, that you stated that we didn't have to actually make the decision about who owns the property. That would be a court decision. And a lot of your arguments have been about deeds and surveys, which I believe will be the matter of the court. But what the other argument you seem to be making is that... the easement across the intertidal zone had to be spelled out in any agreements between the Aykroats and Bordick, and I wasn't sure what the basis for that was. If they believed that they owned the lands, both the upland and the intertidal zone, would they have to still spell out the deed going across the intertidal zone? Could you explain that further?
Yes, just like the Aykroats did not grant an easement over their entire lot, they limited the area where the easement was granted to a very specific 40-foot corridor on the south southern boundary of their, I'll call it the Northport boundary of their lot. They did not grant Nordic the right to put their pipelines anywhere on their land. And so what they granted was only a small stripe across their land that terminates at the high water mark. And in fact, that's how the original dispute arose, because there was a question over whether Nordic could place its pipelines anywhere along the intertidal zone in front of the Aykroats lot, because at the time, in January of 2019, we were all operating under the false assumption that the Aykroats owned that land. But, I mean, to be honest, I went to law school at the University of Virginia and, you know, practiced law most of my career at the Florida Attorney General's Office, where in most states, the state owns up to the high water mark. So the whole colonial ordinance thing is has been quite the adventure to learn. But one of the things I didn't realize is that the upland and the intertidal flats can and often are, over time, severed. And so when I filed the original objection back in January of 2019 that you can't use the entire frontage of the Aykroats lot to establish the littoral zone within which the pipeline configuration could travel, I was saying that you're limited to that 40-foot stripe or the 25-foot permanent stripe of where the easement was granted. But an easement is an interest in land, and it has to be defined very specifically, and it never has included the intertidal land.
Okay. Let me see if staff has questions. Are there questions from staff? Okay, I hear. Yes, who's speaking?
This is Steve Pelletier. Just a quick question to the point that was just discussed about the upland portions of the area that's specifically marked out. And one of the comments that we needed to be, they were looking to be very precise in terms of not disturbing driveways and barns and issues on the upland, which was the reason for being more precise there than others. Is there any, and not having to go beyond into the intertidal? I'm wondering if we could just address that real quick.
Well, they certainly did have an interest in making sure that their barn wasn't disturbed and there were other aspects of it, but clearly the issue is that the easement only exists where the easement is identified as existing, and it is defined by an image, and the image terminates at the high water mark, which is why The department rejected it originally on the 22nd of January, and also Submerged Lands rejected it because it terminated at the high water mark. The letter agreement was provided under the guise that it was somehow expanding and redefining or clarifying that it included the intertidal land, but it never did. The March 3rd letter only says you have the same right to do anything in the intertidal zone that we have a right to do without saying they had a right to do it. Then it was clarified a second time in the December 24th filing, which says we are not representing or warranting that we have any ownership rights at all. And so it is very clear that there has never been a change from the identified boundaries of the easement to extend it into the intertidal land. It does not do it now. It never has done it. The March 3rd letter was interpreted originally by the department and the Bureau as creating an amendment that extended it into the intertidal. We said, no, it doesn't. The words don't say that. But then that issue was resolved when the parties themselves say it doesn't do it. An easement is what the easement says it is, and the easement says it is, by its own terms, terminates at the high water mark.
Understood. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any last-minute questions before I go to Ms. Taranjo? Hearing none, I would like to now go to Ms. Taranjo for Nordic.
Hold on 1 second. This is Peggy Bensinger.
Yes.
I had a quick question for Ms. Tucker. Could you address the letter on page 421 and 422 of the packet? That's a letter that was signed by Richard and Janet Eckrode, in which they apparently agree that they intended a broad easement across their property, including any rights they have to U.S. Route 1 and the intertidal zone, such that Nordic Aquafarms can build and site its pipes anywhere in those areas where they have rights.
Correct. But that statement never says that they have any rights at all, and then the December 24th, 2019 document from them also states, I'm going to give you the page number for that. It is, hold on.
This is Cindy Bertacci speaking. Are you looking perhaps at page 412?
Let's see. Let me look at 412. No, 412 is one of the release deeds. What I'm looking for is the December 24th, 2019 amendment to the application, which stated that the with the whereas clause, and the whereas clause, and I've got it right here. I'm just got to look at the right page for the whereas clause for you. It is that, well, it does say 412 on mine, but 412 here is, yeah, okay, so yes, 412. I'm sorry, Cindy, you're right. 412, the second whereas clause specifically says that there's no representation or warranty is made of any ownership right in the intertidal land by the Eckrodes. So the document that says you can have the right to do whatever we have the right to do in the intertidal zone, including whatever right we have to site a pipe in U.S. Route 1, I think we can all say that no one has a right to put a pipe in U.S. Route 1. And nor do they have a right to go into the intertidal zone to site a pipe. And they're not claiming they are. They're saying they're not claiming they are. But there's what they said in December was we're not representing or warranting we have any ownership rights.
All right. Are there any other questions from board or staff? Hearing none, I will go to Ms. Taranja for her argument.
Good morning, Presiding Officer Duchesne, board members, Commissioner Reed, department staff, and council. Is my volume okay?
Yes, it is.
Thank you for your time and patient review of this project, especially during this very difficult time. Attorney Tucker's arguments have no merit or any support in the department's rules. The commissioner's completeness decision is well supported by evidence and will be upheld on appeal to court, as would any decision by this board regarding right title and interest on the documents that have been submitted by Nordic. There is no basis or jurisdiction for this board to revisit the commissioner's decision. The documents that were submitted as part of the original application include an option to obtain an easement from the Ekros. Understandably, the Ekros were very concerned about what Nordic would be doing and where precisely Nordic would be installing its piping on the upland portion of their property, where they are regularly using their land, particularly their driveway. They were very concerned that anything that would be done around their driveway would not impact their access to their property, and that old buildings would be properly addressed as part of Nordic construction. So those issues and the use on the upland was the subject of much discussion. The Ekros had no concern, as expressed very clearly in the March submission required by the department, to clarify that the Ekros had no concern about Nordic using any of their intertitle or property under U.S. Route 1 in the event they owned to the center line. The whereas clause that has been discussed here was intended to clarify that while the original agreement included language that could be held to require that the Ekros pay for any litigation costs that Nordic might incur in defending their ability to use the Ekros intertitle, that those costs would be borne, that Nordic would bear its own litigation costs, that we would not ask the Ekros to pay to defend Attorney Tucker's suits on behalf of her client. It has nothing, no representation and warranty clause changes anything with regard to underlying ownership and or the Ekros belief. As many of you are very aware, the Ekros are vigorously defending their ownership of the intertitle in court, in federal and state court, against the claims of the Maybe Graces. Attorney Tucker asked this board to do what only a court can do, despite saying things to the contrary. She is asking you to decide who actually owns the intertitle. I'm just an environmental lawyer, but I do have the privilege of calling on my colleague, Dave Callen, who's on this phone, who late last year, as Attorney Tucker pointed out, argued and took the landmark main case on intertitle property ownership, Alameda v. Town of Kennebunkport, and prevailed in that case. And so without further ado, I'll turn it over to him to speak to the intertitle ownership rights.
Thanks, Joanna, and good morning, Presiding Officer Duchesne and honorable members of the board. My name is David Callen, and I'm also representing Nordic Aqua Farms in this matter. Is my volume all right?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. And to answer directly Presiding Officer Duchesne's question to Attorney Tucker, in a deed or an option agreement, a call to the water, including a call to the water at high water mark, includes as a matter of law any rights that extend to the lower water. But that's an ownership issue of law and not a TRI issue of law. The TRI standard is a simple one, and it's plainly met here. As Attorney Benzinger explained, TRI is not a licensing criteria under Chapter 2, Section 11F, referenced by Attorney Tucker. It's an element of administrative standing to seek a permit. TRI is not about who actually owns something. It's about whether there's a sufficient showing that it's not a waste of the board's time to consider a permit. Nordic has submitted an option agreement to purchase an easement from the Ekros. The Ekros deed does not plainly exclude the intertidal zone. That's the end of the story for TRI. The issue has already been decided by numerous decision makers, including the commissioner and this board's presiding officer.
Thank you.
As Ms. Bertacci's memo lays out, the presiding officer denied an identical request on August 23rd, 2019, in the second procedural order, section 12.
Beautiful, a talented man.
So I'll pause for anyone to mute the or to mute their line, so that I'm not trying to compete. But as Ms. Bertacci's memo lays out, the presiding officer denied an identical request on August 23rd, 2019, in its second procedural order, section 12. That decision was not appealed to the board and became final and binding for these proceedings at that time. Tying this quote-unquote renewed motion to Nordic's proffered hearing exhibit 41, which is a red hearing, Exhibit 41 was proffered at the hearing for the limited purpose of demonstrating that a hearing witness had falsely sworn to irrelevant facts, thus calling into question whether the board should trust that witness's sworn testimony on relevant facts. Exhibit 41 had nothing to do with TRI and nothing to do with actual ownership of the intertidal zone. It had only to do with whether the board should trust someone who appeared willing to make false statements under oath. Exhibit 41 does not give the board any reason to revisit the decision made by the presiding officer in the second procedural order, section 12, and that alone should end the board's current analysis of this issue. The board's sister agency, the Bureau of Parks and Lands, has decided the same issue in Nordic's favor and against Attorney Tucker. Indeed, Attorney Tucker's clients, using the same theory of intertidal zone ownership advanced here, filed for a submerged land lease with BPL covering the same submerged land that Nordic seeks to lease from the state. BPL, in addition to noting that it was improper to file a competing lease to block a project, found that under BPL's rules, Attorney Tucker's theory of intertidal zone ownership was insufficient to establish TRI for a submerged land lease sought by her client. This board should do likewise here. Suggesting that the issues in the pending court proceeding filed by Attorney Tucker somehow deprive Nordic of TRI is a similar red herring. While I'm discussing that pending case, if the board could flip in its packet to page 447, that portion of the court's January will have a picture of the properties at issue here. I'd like to highlight that under a different case, the Southridge case, the very existence of a pending court proceeding involving completing claims of ownership is sufficient as a matter of law to establish TRI before a permitting agency like the DEP, including the board. That also could end this analysis. Unlike the simple TRI standard, intertidal zone boundary law is a specialty area of law that can get quite complicated. To illustrate just how complicated, I'll briefly describe the most recent decision issued on intertidal zone boundary law that's already been referenced here by Attorney Tucker, Almere v. the Town of Kennebunkport. In that case, the law firm that represents Upstream Watch in these proceedings brought a lawsuit claiming that different clients in York County owned the intertidal zone of Goose Rocks Beach and could stop people from crossing it. Just as here, Attorney Tucker has brought a lawsuit claiming that her clients own the intertidal zone and can stop Nordic from crossing it. That case involved 110 different waterfront lots. On about 80 of the lots, the parties agreed who owned what, and those waterfront owners settled with the defendant town. On the other 30 lots, the parties couldn't agree because intertidal zone boundary law is complicated. Indeed, it's complicated enough that the trial court decision in that case was almost 300 pages long. In those 300 pages, the court explained that of those 30 disputed lots, the plaintiffs were right as to one lot, and the defendant was right as to the other 29 lots. As Attorney Tucker indicated, I was the attorney who represented the defendant in that case, just as I am the attorney who is representing the defendant in the case brought by Attorney Tucker on behalf of the Maybe Graces. Thankfully, this board does not need to wade into the details of completing claims of intertidal zone ownership. that's a specialty area of law for the courts alone. Here, the board should simply apply the TRI standard in its rules and reaffirm the reasoning of the second procedural order, section 12, end of story. Indeed, the Maybe Grace lawsuit makes clear that Attorney Tucker's tactics in bringing that suit have been to stop Nordic's project and not to obtain judicial resolution of the underlying intertidal zone ownership issue. In January, the judge in that case issued a ruling that because Attorney Tucker's theory of intertidal zone ownership would mean that her clients own not just the relevant intertidal zone, but also the intertidal zone of innocent neighbors on either side of the Eckrose property, that in order for Attorney Tucker's clients to continue with their lawsuit, they must also sue the neighbors on either side of the Eckrose property where Nordic water pipes so that those neighbors can have an opportunity to defend their property rights. If the board looks at the map on its packet, page 447, in that decision, that makes clear that Attorney Tucker's clients are not neighbors to the property where these water pipes will cross. They live two lots down. Indeed, the issue of Attorney Tucker's questionable theory of intertidal zone ownership was fully briefed to the Superior Court back in October of 2019. The most likely reason that the judge hasn't yet ruled on that issue is because, despite the judge's January order, Attorney Tucker has to date failed or refused to join those other necessary neighbors. Were the lawsuit actually about ownership rather than about trying to stop this project, it wouldn't take Attorney Tucker 3 months to comply with the judge's simple order from January. Finally, although the board's TRI rules are found in Chapter 2, if the board wants a simple place to look at a summary of the law on intertidal zone ownership, as reaffirmed by the law court in the Alameda decision, the board needs to look no further than its own rules in the definition of parcel of land under Chapter 371. We'll read the relevant portion of that definition, which is in Section 1, Letter L, Definition of Parcel of Land, Subsection 2. That rule says, and this is a rule that the board is bound by, quote, "In determining the area of a parcel of land, property in the intertidal zone shall be included as part of the property of the adjoining shoreland owner unless specifically excluded by deed. An owner of property located on tidewater owns all land down to the ordinary low water mark, or 1,650 feet, 100 rods, below the high water mark, whichever is less, unless specifically excluded by deed." The department's rule then goes on to explain how the side lot lines of the intertidal zone are calculated. That rule is a concise summary of intertidal zone boundary law in Maine. It's found in the department's own rules. It's what the law court reiterated in Alameda. It holds that when you describe upland property, which by definition ends at the high water mark, and you describe it with a call to the water, including a call measured on that high water mark, that it includes all property rights down to the low water mark unless expressly excluded. Again, the board need not wade into the details of intertidal zone boundary law to reach its decision. The board's rules are plain, its standard is a simple one, and it's clearly been met here. I'd be happy to take any questions that the board or the staff might have.
At this time, I'd like to check with board members to see if any board member has a question.
Hello, Jim, no.
Mr. Pelletier, Mr. Sanford?
None for me, thanks.
Okay, great. Hearing none, I will go to staff for any questions. I hear no questions from staff.
Mr. Mr. Presiding Officer, this is Peggy Bensinger. I do have a question.
Sure, please go ahead.
Are you, either Ms. Taraja or Mr. Callen, arguing that the board doesn't have the authority to return a permit application if it finds an insufficient showing of title right or interest?
The TRI standard is clearly met. The department's completeness determination happens at the time the application is submitted. If no evidence, as you have explained, Attorney Bensinger, such as a court decision that resolves the issue against Nordic occurs in the interim, that new evidence can be presented to the board, and that judicial determination, which would be binding, can then serve as grounds for the board to return an application. But in the posture at issue here, then the department's completeness determination was correct on the record and not appealed to the board. The presiding officer's decision in procedural order 2 was correct on the record and not appealed to the board. And the board previously determined that TRI should not be a hearing topic. All of those decisions were correct when made, and there has been no new evidence since any of those decisions that would give the board new authority now to revisit them. The board would have such authority if the court decision were to come down, but I don't think that it would be proper for the board to do that with the procedural history and the current procedural posture of this case.
Thank you.
If I may pose a question briefly to Ms. Bensinger on that point, I think my understanding is the presiding officers have made a couple of procedural orders as to how we're going to go forward, but the board itself has not made its own independent determination of TRI, whether it's sufficient to go forward, and that the board can make such a determination independent of the original certification of completeness done by the commissioner. How accurate is my assessment?
That's correct. I disagree with Mr. Callen. To the extent that I think the board does have the authority to return the applications if it finds insufficient TRI, and I don't think the board is bound by the commissioner's determination at an earlier date. I think your assessment is correct.
Are there any other questions from either board or staff before I go to Ms. Tucker for rebuttal?
This is Cindy Bertacci. I have one question. Given your argument, is it your position that the easement hasn't been specified across the intertidal, that one would automatically default to the colonial method to determine the ownership or the use of that property, and that it doesn't need to be specified more clearly in any given an easement?
The easement, this is Joanna Taranjo, the easement document and the language of the easement in all of its forms, including the original, was sufficiently broad to include the intertidal. The Exhibit A, which shows the upland portion, was intended between the Eckroats and Nordic. That document was not created for TRI purposes. That was created between Nordic and the Eckroats to show where on their upland Nordic could put its pipes. The clarification that was submitted to the department in March clearly calls out that any AAG Bensinger read moments ago, clearly says the Eckroats are saying you can go anywhere you want, Nordic, in the intertidal or anything we own under U.S. Route 1. Go for it. We don't have any barns or, you know, driveways in those areas, so have at it.
Great.
Just to follow up to that, I mean, on page 61 of the packet, in response to a request by the Department for Information, Nordic submitted a map with the intertidal areas as would be defined by the colonial method. And so I guess I'm looking for clarification as to the basis for asserting that you were granted easement and that it would extend through the intertidal.
Sure, this is Dave Callan again, and I'll jump in just to clarify what the term colonial method is and what that term applies to. That is a method of calculating the side lot lines of intertidal zone ownership. It's not a quote-unquote method of determining whether the rights extend to the low water mark. The colonial method is actually also summarized nicely in section in chapter 371 of the department's rules, but it's actually a common law doctrine of property law in the state that a call to the water, including one along high water, carries with it any rights that the grantor has to low water unless those are expressly excluded. That common law doctrine is actually called a presumptive inclusion or a constructive inclusion in the property description. A call along high water, when it's made as a call to the high water, is the same as a matter of law as describing down to the low water mark. But more fundamentally, it's really kind of a disingenuous argument for Attorney Tucker to be making. There is zero dispute or disagreement between the Ekros and Nordic that Nordic has the rights to go all the way down to the low water if the Ekros have them. There's the idea that somehow the Ekros have not given Nordic the rights to their intertidal zone is, one, wrong as a matter of law because they haven't excluded it. Two, not supported at all by the record because they've sent a letter saying expressly that they had that intent. And so I don't think that there's a real argument at all that the Ekros somehow intended Nordic to only have rights stopping at the intertidal, or at the high watermark. And I'd further state that the Bureau of Parks and Lands, in granting our submerged land lease, which would clearly start at the low water mark, has determined that we have sufficient rights to get to the beginning of that pipe. And there's no reason for the department to second guess that issue.
Okay, are there any final questions or clarifications requested by either board or staff? Hearing none, I'm preparing to go to Ms. Tucker for brief rebuttal. Are you ready, Ms. Tucker?
I am, thank you.
You may go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I want to make sure I unmuted my phone. First, this is an issue of jurisdiction. Jurisdiction in the state of Maine pursuant to case law can be raised at any time, but to the extent that there needs to be new evidence pointed to, the December 24th amendment of 2019 amendment that the parties, Nordic and the Ekros, entered, provided additional evidence, which is why we renewed our motion after that. Going to Mr. Callan's point that unless the adjacent intertidal flats are included with an upland parcel, unless expressly excluded by deed, that is the very essence of this case. The bottom line is that the intertidal area was excluded from this deed according to Nordic's own surveyor, Mr. Dorsky. And I'm going to walk through the pages where to look for this. First, where it says along high watermark of Penobscot Bay to a stake in an outlet of a gully into a pin at the mouth of a bay is at page 107 in the deed. That was the 1946 deed from Harriet L. Hartley to Fred R. Poor. Then the 1971 deed from Fred R. Poor to William O. and Phyllis J. Poor again says to a point in the mouth of the brook, thence easterly and northeasterly along high water mark of Penobscot Bay, 410 feet more or less, to a point at the outlet of a gully. Again, that's at page 108 in your packet. Then the 1991 deed from Fred R. Poor to Phyllis J. Poor states that the waterside boundary is to a point at the mouth of the brook, then easterly and northeasterly along high water mark of Penobscot Bay, 410 feet more or less, to a point at the outlet of a gully. That's at page 122. And finally, in the October 15th deed, at page 144, it says that the unrecorded survey is incorporated. That's the August 31st, 2012 survey by Gusta Ronson of Good Deeds, which is at page 58 of your packet. It says that that is incorporated by reference as the basis for the description in the October 15th deed. And what it says specifically at page 144 is the description above is based on a survey entitled Boundary Survey of the Property of Phyllis J. Poor Estate, dated August 31st, 2012, oriented to Magnetic North, August 2012, by Good Deeds, Inc. And that statement appears at page 144, and the August 31st, 2012 survey appears at page 58 of your packet. That is the survey that expressly shows the two pins at the mouth of the brook and the outlet of the gully, which are above the high water mark, and it shows the high water mark and states that the waterside boundary of the Eckroats lot is along high water. And Gusta Ronson's page 57 letter expressly says that none of those deeds provided any ownership interest beyond the high water mark. But when Mr. Callan talks about includes it unless expressly excluded by deed, all of the recorded deeds in this case, including the 2015 deed that was written incorporating the August 31st, 2012 survey, expressly limits this and excludes the intertidal land from the Eckroats deeds. Then in addition to that, the Eckroats have never granted NAF an easement to use its intertidal zone land. And unlike Southridge, where there was a dispute based on adverse possession by the two competing, the applicant and the person challenging them over the ownership of the land, that applicant had a quiet title action based on adverse possession. Nordic does not. Nordic is not claiming ownership of this land in the pending quiet title action in the Waldo County Superior Court. The Eckroats are making a claim, but the Eckroats haven't granted a right or an easement to Nordic to use this land. So really, the quiet title action has nothing to do with Nordic's claims in this board, because they are not making a claim of ownership or even an easement in that court. And then finally, on the issue of why we haven't joined the other parties, we have an agreement with the party for Dr. Morgan to accept service. We have a pending request in front of the court to adopt a second amended complaint so that we're not serving them with an out-of-date complaint, and the court hasn't ruled on that, and Mr. Callan knows that. In addition to that, we didn't serve the Schweikerts, who just bought the property from the Ties, Lot 37 from the Ties, which does not include ownership of any intertidal land. It excludes it. If you look at sketches 4, 5, 6 and 7 in your packets, you will see that that Lot 37 includes no intertidal land. That's also something that's agreed to by Surveyor Jim Dorsky, Nordic Surveyor. Those documents, we couldn't join the Schweikerts because they were trapped in New Zealand and just got back sometime in early April because of COVID-19. So we can't serve them because they didn't have lawyers that we could go to as part of their process. And they were over in New Zealand and just got back from COVID. So we have not delayed serving them. We're waiting for the court to say what to serve them with, which is a pending motion the court hasn't ruled on yet. And we are immediately, as soon as the court does that, we'll serve them. The problem is that we were supposed to have on
April 10th a state of conference in front of the court, and they pushed that back because of the executive order for COVID-19 entered by the Maine Supreme Judicial Court, and frankly because Mr. Stroud and I both had pending COVID-19 tests, and even though our tests came back negative, they had sat in a freezer for more than 11 days, and nobody's willing to accept the fact that we probably are negative because we both are symptomatic. And so under the court's order, we're not even allowed to walk in a courthouse in the state of Maine right now because we might infect someone. So that's why we haven't done that yet, because we're like Betsy, the little white-faced monkey from Outbreak. Nobody wants to be near us, and I don't blame them. So, in fact, I've thought of changing my name to Betsy. But I wouldn't want to be near me either, and I certainly wouldn't want to go to the court and infect anyone. So that's why we haven't had those hearings, and that's where we are. But I think it was really not appropriate to suggest that we've been sitting on it. We've had things pending since January asking for this second amended complaint, and the court just hasn't ruled on it, understandably. The court has bigger things to contend with during this crisis. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tucker. Are there any questions, or can we go right to Ms. Taranjo? Okay, hearing none, I will go to Ms. Taranjo for a brief rebuttal.
I'm going to defer to Attorney Callan.
Hi, this is Dave Callan again. And the only point that I'd like to make is this distinction between what constructive inclusion means and express exclusion means. To be clear, and this does, I will agree, go to the heart of the argument that they're making, but it is a property law argument, not a title, right, and interest argument. A call along the high wall of the water is an express exclusion of the intertidal zone. Any call to the water of the upland, which by definition, it's in paragraph 8, where the court defines upland, it defines it as only extending to the high water mark. But it holds, as a matter of common law, property law, in the state of Maine, if you describe the upland along the high water mark with a call to the water along that high water mark, it is as if your description had run all the way to the low water mark. So when Attorney Tucker suggests that Attorney Woodward changed the meaning of the deed when he replaced along the high water mark of Penobscot Bay with along said bay, I would say he did no such thing. The Almere case is clear that those two phrases are functionally identical. Neither one is an express exclusion of the intertidal zone. To expressly exclude the intertidal zone, you have to reference it. And there's a lot of case law on the ways that you can reference it. You can call it the intertidal zone, you can call it the shore, you can call it the beach, you can call it the foreshore, you can describe it as a portion of the bank. All of those things are sufficient to expressly describe the intertidal zone. And if you use those terms and you retain as the grantor that portion, that is an express exclusion. But a call along the high water mark is the very thing that Maine's common law property describes as constructively including any rights to low water or 100 rods out, whichever is less. And so with that, that's the only point I have.
Great, thank you very much.
We utterly disagree with that representation. If a call that says along the high water mark.
I'm sorry, who is speaking?
This is Kim Tucker.
Okay, I believe we've already passed through rebuttal. I don't think there's sir rebuttal or whatever it's called after this. But I'm willing to be overruled by the Attorney General's office if I'm incorrect on that.
That's up to the presiding officer.
Under the circumstances where we're trying to do this by phone, I'm going to be quite lenient, I think, because it is difficult. So if you have a brief argument to make, Ms. Tucker, do keep it brief.
We would just disagree that a call that says a long high watermark of Penobscot Bay is a call to the water. And if that were the case, Mr. Callan would have probably lost Almeter. But I would just encourage the members of the board to read the submission by Don Richards that appears in the record, explaining his view of that. He is the expert in this area. But just to be brief, have it concluded. I don't. But just the one thing I would say is, it doesn't matter because the easement that's in front of you doesn't include the intertidal land. So.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions from board members for staff or specifically Ms. Bensinger before we begin deliberations? Okay, I believe I hear none, so I believe we are ready for deliberations. And we have two questions before us at this point based on the presentations and submissions. Number one, does the board want to hold the adjudicatory hearing? In other words, an evidentiary hearing with witnesses and cross-examination on Nordic TRI. If the board votes yes on this question, we stop there. If not, if the answer to question one is no, we go to the second question. Does the board find that Nordic has failed to demonstrate sufficient TRI to warrant processing of the applications, and therefore the board grants the motions and returns the application? Or alternatively, does the board find that Nordic has demonstrated sufficient TRI to allow the applications to be processed, and therefore the motions are denied? So that's where we are at the moment. So I believe we're ready for board deliberations. Is everyone prepared, or is anyone not prepared for board deliberations at this moment? Then I believe we can. Go ahead.
Jim, I'll say about a couple of comments. First of all, regarding this First Aid article, I spent half of my life working around surveyors, and I know that when you get down to colonial law and boundaries on the ocean, it becomes a very complex issue. It's not an issue that I think this board has the expertise to deal with. I think the court is dealing with it appropriately, and I think that's where it should remain.
That's all. Okay, thank you. Mr. Zapper, Mr. Pelletier, either of you have any thing you would like to add because we just deliberate? And this would be on question one. Does the board want to hold an actual adjudicatory hearing?
This is Steve Pelletier. I'm very much in line with what Jim's comment is. This is there's a lot of back and forth here, quite a bit of, it's a number of pages that we've gone through. I'm not comfortable trying to make a determination, even if we did go to adjudication hearing, that, where we would go with that from there. So
okay.
I'm agreeing with Jim that it should be with the courts.
All right. And any other deliberation? I have a couple of my own thoughts I'd like to share, but I'd like to go to Mr. Sanford if you have anything.
This is Rob Sanford. I am feeling the same as Steve and Jim.
Okay, I will make that universal because I'm also feeling the same way on question one. And I guess spell it out a little bit. I think we start out with where the department came down and saying the application was complete for processing. I think that a lot of that is based on the common law presumption of ownership of land, of the colonial methods that we were talking about. There's also the department rule that determines that where the land actually is when it comes to the intertidal zone. So you have all those that have to be overcome in order to say that TRI was not satisfied. And the only arguments presented that really try to overcome that are twofold. One is that the arguments over deeds and surveys, which we all agree is a matter of the courts, not the board. And the only other argument being made is that the easements being granted didn't include the low water mark, which to me on the face doesn't really make sense if the proposal was to put a pipeline there. So I'm not really very comfortable with that argument either. So I believe we can go to a vote on whether or not to accept this, to an acceptance of adjudicatory hearing. And this will be by roll call. So I will first ask Mr. Parker, do you vote yes or no on holding an adjudicatory hearing?
Hold on. You need a motion?
Ah, there is that.
I will make a motion that we hold a roll call vote on whether the board chooses to vote the adjudicatory hearing.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Are you making a motion on whether the board should have an adjudicatory hearing? Yes, or you should make it either.
I'm making a motion that we go to a board vote to determine whether we hold the adjudicatory hearing or not, and put that vote by voice on the phone.
Okay, a board member should make a motion, and the motion should either be, I move to grant the request to hold an adjudicatory hearing, or I move to deny the request to hold an adjudicatory hearing. One of those.
Let me change that to say that I move to deny the adjudicatory hearing.
Is there a second?
Can I repeat it, Tim? You're not coming in very clear.
I move that we deny holding an adjudicatory hearing.
Thank you.
Is there a second?
I'll second that. This is Steve.
Okay, the move to deny an adjudicatory hearing has been moved and seconded. Any further discussion before we proceed to a vote? Hearing none, we'll do this by roll call. I'll ask Mr. Parker.
Yes.
Mr. Sanford.
Yes.
Mr. Pelletier.
Yes.
And Presiding Officer Duchesne also votes yes to deny the adjudicatory hearing motion. I believe that takes us to question two. If the answer to question one is no, we go to the second question on whether to grant or deny the motion to dismiss, in other words, to return without deciding the applications.
I move we deny, this is Jim Parker again, I move we deny the motion to withdraw the application.
To return the application, yes, and is there a second?
I'll do a second on that, please.
We have a motion and a second to deny the motion to return the application. Is there further discussion? Hearing no further discussion, we can go to a roll call, and I'll call on Mr. Parker.
Yes.
Mr. Sanford?
Yes.
Mr. Pelletier?
Yes.
And the presiding officer votes yes as well. Okay, Cindy, can you remind me where we are now in terms of...
Yes, Cindy Bertacci speaking. That now concludes this agenda item, and the persons who don't want to continue can sign off at this point. The board has got